This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Remember when Vice President Cheney said on the first Sunday after the 9/11 attacks, we'll have to work the dark side? Well, that's what Jane Mayer is referring to in the title of her new book, The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. She writes, quote, as part of the war on terror, for the first time in its history, the United States has sanctioned government officials to physically and psychologically torment American-held captives, making torture the official law of the land in all but name, unquote. According to her book, the International Committee of the Red Cross has used the word torture to describe some of the U.S. interrogation techniques. Mayer writes about those techniques and about how the vice president made sure that the White House and Justice Department lawyers came up with legal justification for them and justification for the overall expansion of government powers in the war on terror. Jane Mayer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Jane Mayer, welcome back to Fresh Air. One of the news-making parts of your book is that the International Committee of the Red Cross shared a report last year with the CIA concluding that its treatment of at least one of the, quote, high-value detainees was torture. The Red Cross warned that the abuse constituted war crimes, placing the highest officials in the government in jeopardy of being prosecuted. And the Red Cross was the first and the only outside group to get access to the CIA's 14, quote, high-value detainees. So let's start with the treatment that the Red Cross said constituted torture. Can you give us a description of some of the things the Red Cross found?
Well, what the Red Cross, of course, the report is based on is what the detainees told them. So these are allegations made by the CIA's prisoners. But what the prisoners described were just unending months of torment, really. In particular, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed described having been waterboarded multiple times. He was stripped down in front of, I guess, female handlers. He described a particular number of females involved in his interrogation, which was for sexual humiliation. He described being hung naked by his arms and kept alternately roasting hot and freezing cold and deprived of sleep. And he also described being put on a dog leash on a collar and propelled into the walls of his cells. The other things that some of the others described, Abu Zubaydah particularly described being locked up in something like a dog cage, where it was covered in towels, so it was pitch black and he could barely breathe. And he described it as being put in a tiny coffin. And it was particularly bad for Zubaydah, was one of the detainees who was injured in a gunfight when he was captured. So he said that his injuries sort of popped open while he was in there. There was another detainee named Nashiri who had lost a leg along the way and in his various terrorist activities. And he described having his prosthesis taken away by American officials who made him stand in this forced standing kind of way for hours on end on one leg or foot. So it was just a variety of kind of awful sounding things. And the Red Cross, which is really the foremost authority on the subject of torture and treatment of war prisoners, said that this wasn't even a close call. It was categorically torture and a real problem.
So what did the CIA do with this report?
Well, these reports are very secret, and the whole subject is surrounded in confidentiality. And I must say, I have not seen the report myself. I've had it described to me by multiple sources. So again, this whole subject is a matter of kind of piecing together little pieces of the puzzle. But from what I can tell, the United States government has rejected the report and said it's false, inaccurate, and it also rejects the legal analysis that suggests that top officials in the administration have committed war crimes.
So the Red Cross does warn that the CIA's interrogation techniques do constitute torture and that the highest officials in the Bush administration are in jeopardy of being prosecuted for war crimes. So from what you know, who might be held accountable for war crimes?
Well, it's unclear whether anybody will ever be held accountable for war crimes in this administration. You may remember that I think it was just a week or two ago, General Taguba, who did the report on Abu Ghraib, stated outright, people have committed war crimes and we need to have trials. Are there going to be some? And it's unclear. At this point, we're kind of at a turning point in this subject about how to handle these revelations as they start coming out.
You write that CIA officials have never denied that the treatment of the high-value detainees was approved by Bush. So if President Bush did, in fact, approve what the Red Cross refers to as the torture of the high-value detainees, does that mean that President Bush might be prosecuted for war crimes sometime in the future?
Well, I mean, this is really more of a political question than a legal question. The question is whether there's any appetite in the country for prosecutions. In Congress, there are beginning to be hearings about these things. There have been some people who have suggested that the International Court of Justice might take a look at this. I think that this is really a political question and probably a question for the next administration. It depends on who's president, who the attorney general is, and what the Democrats and opponents of these policies want to see happen.
Now, the Red Cross report that you describe in your new book, The Dark Side, is a secret report, and the Red Cross declined to confirm or deny any details of the report to you. They preferred to keep these kinds of reports kind of secret, just something to communicate to the government in question and not to make public. They think this kind of back-channel approach is more effective. So why did you want to make it public?
I thought it was very important because the U.S. government has kept the treatment of the detainees so secret that this is the first outside, authoritative, independent study that I know of that reexamines their treatment. And I think that the United States needs to evaluate whether these programs have been worth the cost to the moral authority of the country. I think that after 9/11, the Bush administration rushed to embrace torture and lesser forms of coercion as kind of a quick fix. There was panic, and people felt we've got to get the information fast. It's been 7 years, and I think by now we can see there's been all kinds of collateral damage from this treatment, which went outside all the laws that we had before 9/11, and in many ways violated some of our most cherished values in this country and the values on which it was founded.
My guest is Jane Mayer. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker and has been doing investigative pieces on the war on terror. Her new book is called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. The Bush administration worked very hard on making a legal case that would justify their interrogation techniques and the secret detention of prisoners. Now, one of the ways of justifying it was by claiming all of the prisoners in Gitmo were enemy combatants. You cite a report from a CIA analyst who went to Gitmo and said, not everybody in Gitmo is really an enemy combatant. What do you know about that report?
Well, this was actually very early on. This was in the summer of 2002. And by that point, there was already a lot of frustration in the high levels of the government because they weren't getting good information out of the detainees in Guantanamo. And the Pentagon was concerned, the White House was concerned, and the CIA was concerned. They were wondering, you know, why aren't we getting better stuff? And so among other things they did was they sent down to Guantanamo an expert. He was somebody who had spent several decades on the subject of Islamic terrorism. He also was a native speaker in Arabic. And he went down and he interviewed several dozen detainees to try to get their stories and see what was really blocking the interrogation process. And he came back with some very bad news for the White House, which was that, in his opinion, after interviewing people down there, as many as a third of them were mistakes. They were the wrong people. The reason they weren't getting good information, he thought, was in part because they had a lot of people who absolutely didn't know anything. They were just people picked up by accident. So his report, which was very secret and circulated to the top levels in the White House, created alarm among some of the people in the White House, in particular the top lawyer with the National Security Council, John Bellinger. And Belanger went and tried to see if they couldn't do something about this problem. I mean, they felt that it was un-American to be possibly imprisoning innocent people for an indeterminate amount of time down in Guantanamo. And he, in particular, had a meeting with Alberto Gonzalez, who was then the White House counsel, and also with David Addington, who was then the counsel to Vice President Cheney. And he thought that they would naturally want to try to fix this situation and correct it, but they didn't want to do anything about it. In fact, they were irate to be confronted with it. And the Vice President's lawyer, in particular, David Addington, who emerges in this book as a central character in the War on Terror, said, "We're not revisiting this. The president has declared them all enemy combatants. We're not going to change his point of view on this." So it seemed impossible to get most of these people out. I think over time they did manage to spring a few of them, and obviously the numbers have fallen down in Guantanamo. But adding some interesting corroboration to this situation was that when the CIA analyst who was down in Guantanamo brought up this problem to Major Dunleavy, who was then running Guantanamo, and said, "You know, I think a third of them might be innocent." Dunleavy's reaction was, "Well, I think actually it might be more like a half of them are innocent." And belatedly, there was a major study done by Seton Hall, the law school, and where they went very carefully through the transcripts of the detainees and their stories, and they actually concluded that 55% of them were probably innocent, and only 8% had a connection to Al-Qaeda.
Well, what you're saying is when given new information about the real status of detainees at Gitmo, the Bush administration declined to add the new information, to take the new information into account and revisit the decision. The decision was made, so we're not entertaining the new information.
Well, and in many ways, it parallels other things we've seen about how the Bush administration worked. Famously, when Bush was asked in a press conference whether he'd made any mistakes, he couldn't think of any. And there seems to be an imperviousness to new empirical information that might contradict sort of doctrinal positions that they've taken on issues. And to me, it was one of the most interesting things in trying to put together the story, the inside story of the War on Terror, because I think certainly that it's understandable how the country may have overreacted in the beginning. There was panic. There was real fear. There was a sense that we've got to do everything we possibly can to safeguard the country. And I think we all understand that and in many ways support it. But what was interesting was when it began to become clear that there were a lot of problems and they had some of the wrong people. They were getting bad intelligence because of the methods they were using. All kinds of things started to happen. There were a lot of very serious legal problems. There were people who were killed in this program who were in U.S. custody. Instead of fixing it, they sort of stuck to their guns, and it became a very sort of ideologically rigid fight that was pretty much led by Vice President Cheney and his underlings in his part of the White House.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jane Mayer. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker who has been doing investigative pieces on the War on Terror. Her new book is called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the War on Terror turned into a war on American ideals. A lot has been written about the so-called torture memos that were written to justify the interrogation techniques that the CIA was using in Gitmo. You include a memo here I certainly was not familiar with. That was a memo from Lieutenant Colonel Diane Beaver, who was the top legal advisor in Gitmo and helped compile the list of techniques that were acceptable in interrogation. And she wrote a memo arguing that these approaches were necessary and that they were potentially legal if done in certain ways. What were her recommendations for, as you put it, circumventing the criminal codes?
Well, she came up with a very unusual recommendation, which was that for the first time in the United States history, they could have immunity against criminal prosecution that they would offer in advance, so that if they could get it from the top, from the president on down, anybody who participated in this program would not have to face criminal charges. I mean, I'm not a lawyer myself, but I've interviewed a lot of lawyers who thought this was an unusual theory. And I also have talked to people in the top of the Pentagon who gave her points for creativity.
Unusual in the sense that immunity is usually something you get after the crime has been committed, not before you even commit it.
Yeah, I mean, stepping back, it was as if it was a green light to commit crimes. And, you know, we are now facing a point where the question is, should these people who were given a green light to commit crimes be held accountable for the actions that they took? And it's creating a giant political and legal problem, an ethical problem for the country.
Are there other ways in which the Bush administration tried to protect itself against war crimes prosecution, either in the United States or abroad?
Perhaps the most fateful decision made by the Bush administration in terms of legal decisions in the war on terror was made very early on, which was to say that none of the detainees picked up in the war on terror were covered by the Geneva Conventions. The Geneva Conventions are the rules that if you violate them in a grave and serious way, it's considered war crimes. And so by throwing out the Geneva Conventions, the Bush administration thought that it was insulating itself against war crimes prosecutions. But by throwing out the Geneva Conventions, they threw out the rules of war, the laws of war, that have really guarded the United States and other countries from becoming uncivilized in the way that they conduct wars. And they took away the rules and left soldiers in the field kind of up to their own devices, which was put them in a very unfair position. Which brings me to something I want to say that I think is really interesting about this entire subject, which is that the opponents of torture in these years have not necessarily just been people who were at the American Civil Liberties Union. It's not just liberals. It's not just Democrats. It's not a partisan issue. The strongest and most principled opponents of many of these tactics are military leaders. And they are also people who are law and order enthusiasts in the FBI, who basically looked at this when they took away the rule books and said, you know, you're opening us up to chaos and to criminality. And they really believed strongly in the United States Constitution and the United States laws, and they were appalled.
You say that the Bush administration knew better when it said that the interrogation techniques being used at Gitmo were not torture. You write, you know, America helped draft and ratify the 1984 Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel or Inhuman or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, which provided the international law's first explicit definition of torture, which is there are no circumstances whatsoever, whether a state of war or a threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency, that could be invoked as a justification of torture or other acts of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment used to get prisoners to divulge information. And this convention defines torture as severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental. So is that an airtight case that, according to the convention, that our country helped write what happened in Gitmo is torture?
Well, I think that, you know, obviously this is a subject that's been debated and will be debated, but if you ask a number of the people, even in the Bush administration, when they're honest about it, whether they think something like waterboarding is torture, which the entire world has said is torture, and which was torture and prosecutable in the United States until 9/11, they put it this way. Growing numbers of people, even in the administration, have been acknowledging that it is. Richard Armitage, for instance, the Deputy Secretary of State until recently, who is himself a combat veteran from Vietnam and a very tough guy, said, I'm embarrassed we're even having this conversation about waterboarding. It's obviously torture. John McCain, who was himself tortured and is obviously the Republican nominee for president, said, you know, it's not complicated. He said about waterboarding, it's torture. Or John Kiriakou, who is a very young former CIA agent who was actually involved in the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah, one of the first al-Qaeda suspects that we caught. He, at the time, said he was really caught up in the frenzy and he really believed that we should waterboard the guy, and he had been waterboarded himself, so he knew exactly how painful and terrible it is. But afterwards, he said to ABC News, where he gave an interview, that he felt it was torture and he felt it was wrong, and he thinks that America's better than that.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jane Mayer, author of the new book, The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. It's about how the Bush administration, led by Vice President Dick Cheney, called on its lawyers to come up with legal justifications for extreme interrogation techniques and the expansion of executive power. When we left off, we were talking about how the CIA ended up running the programs detaining and interrogating American-held captives who were categorized as enemy combatants. One of the amazing things about the interrogation program is that the techniques that the CIA used were largely based on a program called SEER, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape. This was a Cold War program that was initiated during the Korean War that was used to subject American soldiers to the kinds of harsh interrogation techniques that they might be subjected to if captured so that they'd learn how to resist them. And one of the reasons why this program was put into effect was that 36 American soldiers who were tortured by the Koreans during the Korean War gave false confessions. And so our program is based on techniques that were used and ended up getting false confessions from American soldiers.
It's an incredible irony. This to me was one of the most interesting parts of doing the research. I looked around as a reporter and thought, why is it that we're seeing the same strange techniques being used on detainees in all the places where the U.S. is holding them? I mean, it was true in Guantanamo, it was true in Iraq, and it was true in Afghanistan. You'd see people hooded and shackled in a certain way, deprived of sleep, bombarded with really loud, horrible sounds. There seemed to be a program. I didn't think it was possible that U.S. soldiers could have just kind of freelanced this and come up with it in exactly the same way all around the world. And so I was looking to see, is there a curriculum for this? And what I found was, in fact, there was a rule book for it. And the rule book was in an arcane program, a secret program that's run for the special forces down in Fort Bragg, and actually the other services also have it. Fort Bragg is the Army. The Navy has a version, and the Air Force has a version too. And what this program was for was to recreate torture as it had existed during the Cold War, communist torture, in order to prepare soldiers in case they are ever taken captive so that they could survive and resist it. And these programs became sort of like, I thought of them as like little Petri dishes where they kept the virus alive in order to inoculate soldiers against it. But what happened in the War on Terror was that the people who ran those programs wound up being turned to as experts on how to interrogate people. And that little virus in the Petri dish got out and spread through the United States military and through the CIA. So it became actually the curriculum for how we were going to interrogate people ourselves. And it was something that had been used originally to get false confessions out of people by communists, so that we wound up emulating the tactics of what we called the evil empire. And it had never been designed to get the truth. It had always been used to get false confessions. And inevitably, of course, what happened was we wound up getting a lot of false intelligence out of people.
So the premise was, if you subject somebody to enough pain, they'll tell you whatever you want to hear.
Well, that's the idea, and it's not just pain. Actually, the program that they emulated is also a one of psychological destruction. It's as much psychological as it is physical, really.
Such as?
They did a lot of psychological research during the Cold War years in the CIA to try to figure out what made people give false confessions and whether there was some kind of brainwashing. And what they found out was that if you subject people to severe isolation, where you really cut them off from all stimuli, you give them goggles, you give them, cover up their hands so they can't feel anything, keep them in the dark, they don't know what time it is, they can't talk to anybody, they even tried suspending people in water tanks, you give them white noise, before long, people go crazy. And they also become very dependent upon their captors. and bond with them. And the idea was that we can manipulate them psychologically in order to get them to talk to their interrogators, because they're going to be so desperate to have some kind of human bond. And so that kind of research was went into our Cold War CIA science experiments, and it wound up being taken back off the shelf. The reason that we turned to these arcane and exotic programs was that, in truth, the CIA had not had a lot of experience interrogating people. The CIA before 9/11 didn't hold prisoners. That was the province of the criminal justice system in this country, and the military. And the military and the criminal justice system had very strict rules for what you could do. But suddenly after 9/11, the CIA had its own prisoners and didn't really know how to interrogate them, and they turned to the wrong people.
So, you know, you can understand why certain communist governments wanted false confessions. They want you to say, basically, I have sinned and the communist government is great, you know, to say that on the record.
Right. It's very useful for propaganda purposes.
Exactly. But theoretically, that's not what the Bush administration wanted. It wanted real information about real terrorists. Is there any evidence that we've gotten any real information about real terrorists and terrorist plots through these interrogation techniques?
The record of what the Bush administration got out of the terror suspects who they tortured or coerced or used enhanced interrogation techniques, call it whatever you want, is secret still. We have not been able to examine the record. We don't have the interrogation transcripts. But those who have seen them have raised a lot of really disturbing problems about what they've produced. For instance, Jay Rockefeller, who is the senator who is the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, put out a statement not so long ago saying, from everything he knows, and he knows as much as almost anyone about this program, there's never been a reason to torture anyone. There's no reason that they needed to move to these techniques. I think that it would be very useful if we could have more information to make these evaluations, because what we're left is going on what the CIA has said about how valuable it is and what President Bush himself has said about how valuable it is. But they've got such a vested interest in this at this point. They haven't even launched, for instance, a Team B to go in and try to figure out whether or not this was necessary. So it's very hard to get to the bottom of what they got from this program. They claim it worked. I think there are all kinds of counterclaims that have started to surface.
Did the Bush administration think it would have more control over the detention and interrogations, and that it could keep those detentions and interrogations more secret if the CIA oversaw it as opposed to the U.S. military?
Well, yes. In a word, yes. I mean, the thing is that the U.S. military is governed by strict rules. The Uniform Code of Military Justice pretty much controls what the military can do in the way of interrogating people. They can't do inhumane things. And so if you really want to rough somebody up, you're going to have to turn someplace else. And the CIA doesn't have those laws governing it, especially after 9/11, when the administration came up with legal rulings that said that if you hold a foreigner outside of U.S. territory, you're not governed by U.S. laws.
Part of your book is about how dissent within the Bush administration about how we were dealing with secret detention facilities and interrogation that many people have described as torture, how dissent about that within the Bush administration was squashed. Give us some of the more extreme examples of how that was stopped.
Well, almost from the start, there were people who said, when these extreme ways of treating prisoners were proposed, they said, you know, this is outside of America's tradition. Since George Washington, we have been leading the cause of human rights and particularly in the treatment of prisoners of war. We've always tried to be the most humane country in the world. When lawyers in the administration tried to stand up for what they thought was the law, and it was a different interpretation from that from Cheney's office in particular, they often found themselves ostracized and careers came to an end. Some of the lawyers felt themselves to be in such danger, really. They feared retribution from the vice president's office to the point where two of them actually resorted to having to talk in codes, and they thought they might be in physical danger. And those two were Jack Goldsmith, who was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel, and James Comey, who was the number two guy in the Justice Department, the Deputy Attorney General. And both of them were busy trying to withdraw the torture statute and fix the law on this area, but they really just became, you know, almost paranoid about whether they could do this without facing danger.
Now, you're right that there was a group of Bush administration lawyers who wanted to challenge the SEER program, and that's the Cold War program of interrogations that the Gitmo model was based on that we were talking about a little earlier. And the radical plan of action that this group of Bush administration lawyers drew up to oppose the SEER program was called the Big Bang. So they wanted to shut down the secret detention centers and shut down the interrogation program. What was the plan and why did it fizzle?
The Big Bang was, I mean, the reason they called that was they thought that it was going to take the bureaucratic equivalent of dynamite to blow up this program. They had tried to work through the channels in the White House, and every time they tried to get anywhere, they got squelched by, mostly again, by the, it was quite incredible, but Vice President Cheney and his office really seemed to kind of control these issues. And so they decided they were going to have to try to go behind the Vice President's back. And they met in secret in the Pentagon one weekend and drew up a plan that was going to be a potential speech for Bush to give, closing down the CIA's black prison sites, transferring their prisoners to Guantanamo, and calling for an end to Guantanamo eventually, and putting everybody on trial so that they finally had some kind of due process. And what they drafted a very eloquent plan and speech, and they were going to give one copy to Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, and the other copy was going to go to Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense. And they hoped then that those cabinet secretaries would be able to give it to the president going around the vice president. So what happened was the first part of the plan worked well. Condoleezza Rice really liked it, and she was ready to try to get on board and give it to President Bush. But Rumsfeld was absolutely furious that they had done this without consulting him. And in fact, they felt really in truth that he just opposed the plan, but used this sort of bureaucratic anger to try to shut it down. And so when a meeting was scheduled to discuss the Big Bang plan in the National Security Council and Rice was going to try to discuss it, Rumsfeld said he absolutely refused to participate unless they would not discuss that subject. They could talk about Guantanamo, but they couldn't talk about the Big Bang. So it died on the vine. And, many people wondered how much of the information that was critical of these programs really reached President Bush. They felt often that the vice president kind of strangled the paper flow so that the president really didn't learn about a lot of the problems in these programs.
Why? Was it giving the president deniability?
It could be a question of deniability. It could also be a question of just grabbing the power and taking control. One of the things that I learned that I thought was very interesting was that the vice president's lawyer and now chief of staff, David Addington, has had the last box. Paper went through his office last before it went to President Bush on these national security issues. So whoever got the last dibs on the paperwork before it went to the president pretty much got to decide what options he was given and what he saw. And that is always, I've covered a number of White Houses, that is always an incredibly key position to be in. Because as we know, President Bush calls himself the decider, but if you're only deciding among options that are predetermined, sometimes you don't have the full range of information.
In the story, the way you tell it, Vice President Cheney really emerges as the kind of commander of the war on terror, not of the troops, but just of the overall strategy. And his chief counsel, David Addington, is the legal mind expanding executive authority to make all this happen. And although it's expanding executive authority, presidential authority. It's really Vice President Cheney who's doing all of the analytical work to make it happen rather than the president himself. The president himself is just signing off on it. An accurate representation of the picture the way you're describing it?
Yeah, it was an irony to me that basically the argument made by Cheney and his lawyer is always, we need to expand the power of the president. The president gets to decide these issues. But as one of the top White House officials said to me, who was an opponent of this, some of this program, that, you know, he wondered how often did the president really make these decisions and how many of the decisions were made by Cheney. Frequently, they were made by Cheney. I mean, I did my best to document it. And I think, you know, there's plenty more for historians and other reporters to try to dig up. But you can really see that the fingerprints of the vice president and his office are all over the national security policy.
You know, in discussing the Bush administration and al-Qaeda, you describe how the Bush administration kind of swung from one extreme to another, that before September 11th, the Bush administration was either ignoring or downplaying all the information it was getting about the threats of al-Qaeda, and it got a lot of information. But then after September 11th, the Bush administration became obsessed with al-Qaeda and doing absolutely anything to stop them, including what many people believe is the torture of detainees. And you write about Vice President Cheney in particular here, about how a lot of people close to him felt that he became paranoid, in part because he insisted on reading the intelligence firsthand. You say he distrusted the CIA and he wanted to see the information firsthand, but he was getting that information unfiltered, unscreened. Why was that a problem?
I'm so glad you asked about this, because I actually think it's a really interesting dynamic that took place in the Bush White House right after 9/11, which was that both Cheney and Bush, but Cheney in particular, wanted to see what's known as raw intelligence. They didn't want it analyzed by the CIA, and they wanted to see everything. And what this meant was that they were just completely bombarded with all kinds of horrible possible threats from all around the world. Everything the United States government was able to sort of vacuum up of enemy actions against the United States. And what experts said to me, intelligence experts said to me, I quote Roger Cressy is one of them in this book, who was at the National Security Council, that they thought it was a big mistake, because what the vice president and president were getting was a lot of bad information. You get a lot of bad information with the good, a lot of unreliable reports that would be everything from people plotting nuclear attacks on the U.S. to anthrax attacks, all kinds of awful things. But the president and the vice president started every day looking at this stuff. And a number of people who saw these reports, they were called the Threat Matrix Report, felt that it really tainted their outlook in a way that might have almost thrown off their judgment.
Because they were taking all of the false information mixed in with the real information and considering everything a threat, even if it was just junk.
Right. I mean, and ordinarily, what in the past, what the CIA has done is had morning briefings, of course, with presidents, but they only present what they feel is reliable and really worrisome. In this case, they just threw the whole kitchen sink in, and it was full of stuff that you know came from, you know, people phoning it in because they imagined they saw something awful when, you know, who knows whether it was or not. There was no work done to try to evaluate the intelligence. It was just all just thrown at the president and vice president. And people who knew Cheney for a long time, I talked to one man who was a longtime family friend of the Cheneys and really likes Cheney a lot. But he said that after 9/11, he changed. He just seemed steely. And he has a pretty known for having a really good sense of humor, actually. But it was as if he had seen something terrible, this man said to me. I think also that it's very hard for anybody outside of the government to be able to understand the amount of responsibility and worry that they felt, that if they didn't do everything they possibly could, America was going to be hit by a terrorist attack again, maybe a worse one, maybe even a nuclear attack. I mean, they had to live with this responsibility. And I've tried in the book to at least understand them and give them credit for trying to protect the country. They it's not that they were a gang of criminals who were doing something wanton for fun. These are people who felt they were doing what was required and necessary to protect the country. But and so they just went to extraordinary lengths, and I think that that what happened was, as it became more clear that many people felt they'd gone too far, they couldn't turn back.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jane Mayer. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker who's been writing investigative pieces about the war on terror. Her new book is called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. At the end of your book, you write, what began on 9/11 as a battle for America's security became and continues to be a battle for the country's soul. I'm going to ask you to elaborate on that.
Well, this is really very much why I wanted to write this book, was I felt that while I was writing stories about torture and rendition and some of these, the extreme practices in the war on terror that seemed so depressing, people would say to me, why, how can you write about this stuff? It's so depressing. And in truth, what I knew was that all along the way, there were people who were standing up against it, who were, in my view, very patriotic, and who felt that this was a there was another front in the war on terror. It wasn't just the U.S. versus the terrorists. There was also kind of a civil war inside America, which was this battle for America's soul. And there were a lot of people who just felt in the military that this wasn't right, and that we faced worse enemies and not descended to their level like this. There were a lot of people in the FBI who stood up and said, we're not doing this. We don't torture people. That's what our enemies do. And spoke out internally. There were a number of lawyers in the Bush White House who did so too. And I guess I felt that there was a real live battle, an incredibly interesting struggle going on to define how do we keep the country safe without mortgaging our ideals. And I what I wanted to tell partly in this book was the story of that fight. It's a fight that's really a moral fight, an ethical fight, a historic fight, and I think something that I really wanted the country to think about, know about. So that's what I meant about the struggle for America's soul.
When it comes to the presidential campaign, what are the issues pertaining to the war on terror that you'd like to hear McCain and Obama directly address?
Well, these are very politically fraught issues. So far, I feel like the debate has not been very sophisticated on these areas. But among the questions are, what are we going to do with the people in Guantanamo? And what are we going to do with future terror suspects? Are we going to bring them back inside the criminal justice system and treat terrorism as a crime as we did before 9/11? Or are we going to give them the rights of prisoners of war and treat them treated as a war? What is the overlay of those two things? Do we need to try to create a system of preventive detention as Britain has been doing now in order to hold terror suspects till you can see whether they're criminals? These are really complicated and very important subjects. I think that a lot of what people have not dealt with is an honest discussion of whether the old paradigm, the criminal laws, whether they were really inadequate. In fact, that if you compare the two things, take a look at the Bush administration's approach and the approach before 9/11. Before 9/11, the Justice Department prosecuted terrorists as criminals, and many of them are serving life sentences. They were convicted and kept off the streets. Since 9/11, we've prosecuted them as illegal enemy combatants. Not a single one of them has stood trial. There's been one plea by David Hicks. The rest of them are just in limbo. It's been 7 years. This process, there are plenty of reasons to think what we're doing is not working, and I really think I'd like to hear the candidates talk about what would work better.
Jane Mayer, thank you so much for talking with us.
I'm so glad to be here with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Jane Mayer's new book about the war on terror is called The Dark Side. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.